It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker, a production of the AS21 Podcast Network, available on Podomatic, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Play, and media.as21.com. Episode 1, Putin's Rasputin.
I leant upon a coppice gate when frost was spectre grey and winter's dregs made desolate the weakening eye of day. The tangled vine stems scored the sky like strings of broken lyres, and all mankind that haunted nigh had sought their household fires. The land's sharp features seemed to be the sentry's corpse outlent, his crypt the cloudy canopy, the wind his death lament. The ancient pulse of German birth was shrunken hard and dry, and every spirit upon earth seemed fervorless as I. At once a voice arose among the bleak twigs overhead, in a full-hearted evensong of joy illimited. An aged thrush, frail, gaunt, and small, in blast-beruffled plume, had chosen thus to fling his soul upon the gloom. So little cause for carolings of such ecstatic sound was written on terrestrial things afar or nigh around, that I could think there trembled through this happy good-night air some blessed hope whereof he knew, and I was unaware. Thomas Hardy was born a little too late. He was a generation younger than the Victorian intellectuals who represented merry old England at its great optimistic zenith of the Victorian era. Writers and thinkers like Dickens and Thackeray and Tennyson and John Stuart Mill and Matthew Arnold and George Eliot and Cardinal Newman and Thomas Carlyle and John Ruskin and Benjamin Disraeli and William Gladstone. Men, and at least one woman who took a man's name, so influential that they defined a country and a century. The world has moved on from their overly proper and priggish optimism and their peculiar and pecuniary liberalism, but it was, for better or worse, probably the best the world was going to do in the 19th century, and a hell of a lot better than what lay in store in the start of the 20th. The only way that a still greater and more equitable liberalism than the Victorian liberalism that allowed from the vicissitudes of imperialism and would ever be born was to emerge from a meat grinder of death. A blood sacrifice which demanded more than 200 million victims and made no distinction between the conservatives who held a more equitable world back, the progressives who aimed to create a greater world, and the already oppressed of the European lower classes and oppressed of imperial rule in Asia, Africa, and occasionally Latin America, the very people who could have benefited most had they survived the great harvest. Was it worth it? Hardy was one of nature's great pessimists. English literature was ruled at the mid-19th century by Charles Dickens, the ultimate optimist and a poet of hope who passed his characters through terrible tribulations so that they might emerge more triumphant at the end. Late century English lit was ruled, if by anyone at all, by Hardy. Two-thirds of the way through his career at roughly the century's turn, he abandoned novels for poetry, perhaps because he had too much gloom in his outlook to render any longer his sour thoughts on life with the ambiguities that narrative demands. When he wrote those immortal 16 couplets of the darkling thrush, was his foreboding for his own soul's future? Was it foreboding for the people he loved? Was it for England's? The world's? We are now 117 years after the darkling thrush, and there are people alive in 2017 that were alive in 1900, none of whom was born before 1899. No one is alive today who can tell us whether or not living in 2017 feels like living in 1900. But I would imagine that a certain kind of liberal felt a foreboding that could not be quenched. The historian, Neil Ferguson, no liberal he, wrote of 1901 that an inhabitant of London could, as he sipped his breakfast tea, have ordered a sack of coal from Cardiff, a pair of kid gloves from Paris, or a box of cigars from Havana. He might also, if anticipating a visit to the grouse moors of Scotland, have purchased a Brattlebane waterproof and self-ventilating shooting costume, cape and kilt. Or he might, if his interests lay in a different direction, have ordered a copy of Maurice Seeheim's book entitled The Schoolboy's Special Immorality. He could have invested his money in any one of nearly 50 U.S. companies quoted in London, most of them railroads like Denver and Rio Grande, whose latest results were also reported that day, or, if he preferred, in one of the seven other stock markets also covered by the Times. He might, if he felt the urge to travel, have booked himself passage on a P&O liner Peninsular, which was due to sail for Bombay and Karachi the next day, or on one of the 23 other P&O ships scheduled to sail for eastern destinations over the next 10 weeks. Say nothing of the 36 other shipping lines offering services from England to all corners of the globe. Did New York seem to beckon? The Manitou sailed tomorrow, or he could wait for the Hamburg-America line's more luxurious Fürst Bismarck. which sailed him from Southampton on the 13th. Did Buenos Aires appeal to him more? Did he wish to see for himself how the city's Grand National Tramway Company was using, or rather losing, his money? Very well. The Danube, departing for Argentina on Friday, still had some cabins free. The world, in short, was his oyster. Where stand we in 2017? An inhabitant of the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area, as he, or still depressingly seldom she, sips on their Sunday brunch mimosas, can whip out an iPhone and go on Amazon and there order 5 pounds of replica fat for $70, an old Asian man peel and stick wall decal for $30, a Nicolas Cage pillowcase for $8, 2 ounces of weed for $5, and a Kalen's hand butt plug for $30, a 55-gallon drum of lube for $1,350, a Roswell, New Mexico soil sample for $16, a Bedonkadonk Land Cruiser for $20,000 and $500 shipping, an infant circumcision trainer for $192, 1,500 ladybugs for $6.25, a sexy inflatable sheep made to look like Dolly the First clone sheep for $7.50, a Stegosaurus costume for $28, 32 ounces of wolf urine for $100, an underpants dispenser for $11, a complete body unitard for $70, and uranium ore for $40. If they wanted to book a trip to anywhere in the world, they could find literally hundreds of websites devoted not only to saving money on the trip, but earning money by taking a trip. They could find online classifieds for house swapping and house sitting and dozens of websites to advise them on how to get the most value on it. They could be subsidized for years by a nonprofit to volunteer and fundraise on a development project. They could look on online forums for hitchhiking and carpooling, and many websites devoted exclusively to how to do either or of them safely. Message boards for staffing yachts and advice on how to crew it. Applications to crew on a cruise on any of the major cruise lines' website. They can inquire onto car rental sites for people who've just moved and need vehicles driven from the place they live to a far-off place. They can offer to work at a hostel rather than pay it. They can organize a group tour for which they act as both agent and guide. Some people would say that this is the way that the world's true masters anesthetize us to the world's truest concerns by dangling consumerism and commodities in front of us and forcing us creative types to hustle our way into the lower middle class while the less imaginative and risky of us reap the world's true benefits. Many others, including me, would say that this is evidence that the world is particularly our oyster. The reason we focus on how to procure our own trivial delights is not because we are slaves to the world, but because we are its masters. And once again, the world may demand remittance on our trivial concerns with a payment not in dollars or coin of the realm, but in pounds of flesh.
Thank you.
Greetings, salutations, welcome, and all due appropriate sentiments to this episode number one. Let's start with the first thesis of this series and then divert enormously from it. We have just emerged from the television era. I believe that in the past generation, it is not movies or music that has represented us most accurately, however well some in each field of the arts do, and it's certainly not fiction or art. Far more than any other medium, TV gives its creators the freedom and diversity to show our lives accurately, and I aim to show that as best I can. This podcaster was born at the cusp between Generation X and Millennials. We were not only born in the television era, but even our parents can't remember a time before television. But our parents grew up with three basic networks. We grew up with 30. And by the time we became adults, we had 300. I would imagine that we are now in the podcast era. Hence why I'm here. But in some ways, there is as great a difference between TV and television as there is between either of them and podcasts. TV is entertainment. Television is art. TV is escapist. Television is cathartic. TV exists to comfort us. Television exists to drive us mad. I would date the emergence of television from TV to somewhere between the final episode of Seinfeld in May 1998 and the pilot episode of The Sopranos in January of 1999. Something in the American air changed sometime during the last 7 months of 1998, much as they seemed to change again around the fall of 2014. The 30s were the decade of fascism. The 80s were the decade when communism fell. The 90s were the decade of the blowjob. The quote-unquote great event, the most famous of 1998 and indeed of the whole decade, was the Lewinsky investigation and the Clinton impeachment, which everyone, both right and left, agreed represented an absolute low in American discourse during a period so seemingly prosperous and indolent that the country had nothing better to do for an entire year than to talk about the president getting head underneath the desk of the Oval Office. Nevertheless, this roughly seven-month period between Seinfeld and The Sopranos set much of the stage for everything that would later come, no pun intended, honestly. The great political development of that period was the emergence, and a word like emergence hardly does it justice to the effect it had on America, of the Drudge Report. Traditional news, even 24-hour TV news, even Fox News, could not possibly keep up with the proliferation of trivial but distracting political stories or entirely made-up stories that cater to and inflame the prejudices of people who believe in the inherent bias of traditional respectable journalists who practice journalism through the same process since the founding of The Spectator in the 1720s. And if not that many millions of people believe that traditional news had no bias before the Drudge Report, then the Drudge Report alone convinced millions. No newspaper, not even the Wall Street Journal, no yellow journalism, not even the Daily Mail, no television network, not even Fox News, could ever shape hearts and minds with the ferocious prowess of an aggregating website that could send its audience down a rabbit hole of information, often false but certainly not always, that was available to them at the click of a mouse. But if you think that the Drudge Report isn't a substantial enough event to mark the passing of one era to the other, then for this period that contributed to American life and history, one should remember that this was the period when the bulk of the debate was conducted over whether to repeal the Glass-Steagall Act, a financial act barely passed more than 3 months into the Franklin Roosevelt administration. Glass-Steagall was the most important substance of the Banking Act of 1933, which established a wall between commercial banks and securities firms. What Glass-Steagall meant in layman terms is that a commercial bank at which middle-class people could store their money with expectations that the money would stay put could not itself be invested in stocks and funds so that banks could potentially make more money for both the bank and its customers. In theory, eliminating the separation can reap incredible financial benefits to both bankers and their customers. And in practice, that's exactly what happened until the Great Recession of 2008, just as it's exactly what happened until the Great Depression of 1929. Both times, it was shown pretty much definitively that commercial banks trying to increase their holdings through the stock market was spectacularly irresponsible. I suppose I'm giving away my political bias right at the beginning of this series. Are there really that many conservative podcasters anyway? You'll quickly see that compared to most progressive podcasters, I'll seem downright conservative, but I am a liberal through and through, clinging to it like a religion in insecure times precisely because liberalism is the most insecure of all philosophies. A coreless, constantly evolving and debated theology that ultimately seems to adapt itself from era to era to the specific needs of that particular historical moment. But regardless of whether one is liberal or conservative, modern or progressive, alt-right or intersectional warrior for social justice, everyone seems to agree that something extremely dangerous happened in American life during this period, even if we all disagree about what the particular dangers were that we passed. Whatever the center of American life was, whatever Americans' basic expectations and routines were, it seemed to be hollowed out sometime around that infamous year of 1998. Around the corner was the 21st century, and while America is still unquestionably the world's only superpower, we are all the more vulnerable because of our indispensability. And every American would seem to agree that the 21st century beset our country with an endless parade of hopelessness. Not hopelessness by the standards of history, but hopelessness by the standards of the most prosperous and wealthiest nation in the history of our planet. Nobody knows what 2017 will bring, but there is no question, even until January 20th, 2017, that a person desiring to make a success of him or herself has the best possible chances right here and right now to rise and lift oneself from poverty. Lifting oneself from poverty does not mean alleviating one's hardships through social programs while still contenting oneself with little more than a minimum the living wage, as progressives like to believe. And contrary to what conservatives believe, it can be done while still respecting the economic rights of communities and refraining from the exploitation of others to achieve one's goals. But to rise in financial security and status to a place of self-respect and pride and to create an identity, a security, a future, a career, and a freedom for oneself is still something that has happened in America tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of times more often than any other place in the world. Since I would imagine that it is mostly liberals and progressives and socialists who would listen to this, I would like to point out to them a certain quote. "The lessons of history, confirmed by the evidence immediately before me, show conclusively that continued dependence upon relief induces a spiritual and moral disintegration fundamentally destructive to the national fiber. To dole out relief in this way is to administer a narcotic, a subtle destroyer of the human spirit. It is inimical to the dictates of sound policy. It is in violation of the traditions of America." This quote was from the 1935 State of the Union Address, and it was given by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. The human spirit, spiritual and moral disintegration. How old-fashioned, how out of touch, how quasi-religious and conservative, how bourgeois these terms sound to the enlightened modern ear, which can't help but hear the echoes of Bill O'Reilly or Newt Gingrich or Margaret Thatcher talking about the corrosive effects of dependence on a citizen's ability to lift himself up by the bootstraps. But what other option has there ever been? What other motivator moves a society to prosperity? Socialists and Marxists, sometimes even progressives, would have us believe that a dream of self-respect is just something that we all have innately if companies and their advertisers did not constantly deny them to us. According to many such people, we are all part of the lies told from inside the whirlwind of the great neoliberal machine, which gives us feelings of security and freedom and achievement precisely by taking these feelings away from us and always depriving us of any real version of all three. The various substrata of leftist religions can never seem to agree upon a solution to this matter, the reason being as clear as day to its doubting Thomases that there can be no solution to a problem that doesn't exist. Neither corporations or governments can deprive us of self-actualization when they are both extraordinary products of the human mind and its miraculous powers of organization. Both public and private organizations can be and are used for good and ill, and both are used for good and ill billions of times every day. The problem is neither corporations nor governments. The problem is the messy minds that thought of them both, organized them both, keep both running, use them both, exploit them both, and heal them both. Just as President Obama says that we are the ones we've been waiting for, we are also the ones keeping ourselves waiting. It is neither possible nor desirable to eradicate either or even shrink them significantly. But even if it were, it would be in the interests of every living being on the planet to keep both of these literally superhuman entities, which simultaneously control us and are controlled by us, to operate in good health and be as representative of our interests as any organization can possibly be by being so inflexible in how both are regulated that we endow both with the flexibility to check the most oppressive impulses of the other. No matter what Jacobin intersectionalists say to discredit it, no matter what Fox News conservatives say to discredit it, no matter how many times Bill Clinton, like moderates, acceded to conservative demands to dismantle it, no matter how effectively the alt-right will assault it in the future, there is only one way to live your best self, and that is self-creation. And at this moment in time, America, wounded as she clearly is, and perhaps even mortally wounded, is still the best place to do it. At this point in our chats, I have to take a moment to point out that I very much realize that all this is especially rife in hypocrisy when coming from a chronic, manic, and melancholic and learning disabled person who is therefore perhaps the last person deserving of a show on intellectual matters. I'd like to think my reading is impressively wide, but if the breadth of it is impressive, then the lack of discipline of it is truly astonishing. I will be talking about books that I have in no way come close to finishing, cherry-picking chapters all over the place, ripped from their contexts, and necessarily simplified. I am in every sense, one of those 19th century cultivated amateurs, dilettantes who soaks in a little bit of a subject at a time and calls it knowledge. I don't think much of a lot of academia, where specialties are, as the saying goes, a mile deep and an inch wide. But they wouldn't think much of me either, because I'm their mirror image, a relic of a kind of unspecialized pseudo-erudition that created modern academia's condition in the first place. I am also someone whom thus far in his adult life has, to his humiliation, relied upon all manner of social welfare doles from family, friends, and in mercifully few instances, the state itself. All I can say in my defense of bad-mouthing the impulses to mercy and pity that let a ne'er-do-well white male born to upper-middle-class privilege like me live, and perhaps even live well, is that I'm all too intimately, all too infinitely, all too regrettably familiar with the humiliating corrosion of welfare and how it can erode a human being's self-respect. So much for partial disclosure. There are, thankfully for me at least, structural balances that favor people like me and prevent me from falling into the worst situations which the world has to offer. Nevertheless, I think I've earned, at least to a small extent, the right to be critical of the institution. A person who requires any manner of social welfare should be able to get access at the first possible opportunity. But if it can at all ever be avoided, the price of a person's knowledge that they have been forced to declare themselves unable to cope with life's vicissitudes without assistance on the most existential levels is a burden greater than many of us can ever bear. But if we all let our personal hypocrisies hold us back from saying what statistics tell us is true, then the world would be a less knowledgeable place. To anyone willing to read the history and statistics, it should be obvious that American liberalism has achieved more in less time than any nation in the history of the world. Let's just take one obvious example. Since 50 years ago, poverty has fallen by 1/6 its level. Since 65 years ago, poverty has fallen by nearly 40%. And this is during a period when the population of America vastly increased. Imagine what might have happened had conservatives not cut and demonized Lyndon Johnson's Great Society programs. We did not end poverty. We did not even come close. But we lifted 50 million people out of it whose ancestors never knew anything but poverty, and we lifted their children and their grandchildren, and soon, let us pray, their great-grandchildren. How many hundreds of millions are now more secure for what the United States government accomplished with the Great Society? This is just one of 100 areas where America's achievements defy description, most of which we hope I'll have something resembling the intelligence to enumerate here in detail. So here's the problem. Why are we all so hopeless? 2 years ago, there was a Wall Street Journal poll that should break everybody's heart because it showed that everybody's heart was already broken. Why is it that the America of 1967, segregated and rioting, perpetually terrified of nuclear Armageddon, wading into the mud and shit of the first war America would ever unquestionably lose, was so much more hopeful than we are today? Time and time again, post-war America achieved great and unprecedented things, but rather than fortify us and give us confidence for the next challenges, they exhausted us and depleted us of the ability to keep meeting them. Every hope that America would become a better place to live in these 50 years was born out, every one of them, and yet every hope seemed to die. We have achieved the better new world for which many of our grandparents and parents fought in all sorts of ways, both militarily and, more importantly, civically. But not only did this new world turn out to be not that great, it also turned out that this better world often seems terminally ill. In January 1967, we were secure that the future would be better. In January 2017, America is better, and the world probably is too, but we are anything but secure. We'll be right back. It is impossible to look at art and not perceive in it some way in which it tells the story of the area and the era in which it was conceived. And it's furthermore impossible, much as aesthetes like Vladimir Nabokov would disagree, to look at art without reading parallels in it from the real world, or from our own lives, or from the lives of people we know and love or hate or to whom we're ambivalent, or parallels from the metaphysical cosmos at large and those basic microcosmic but still deep truths of life and existence. One of art's great secrets is its societal tremors. I don't think it's an exaggeration to repeat that old truth that art is a societal seismograph. With obvious exceptions, of course, a secure era always seemed to be dominated by secure art in which the rules are as clearly defined as the rules of the society at large. The vast majority of the 18th century, with its intricate and unbreakable monarchical hierarchies, was the archetype of a society in which art was created with extremely distinct rules so as not to upset the precarious balance of an incredibly intricate societal structure. Just about all American and European buildings seem designed with the kind of columns one finds in ancient Greece or Rome or even Egypt, and the fact that they imitated a pagan era rather than a Christian one was not an accident. The heights and lengths of the buildings were determined by the mathematical ratios found in nature so as to provide the most harmonious possible surroundings. Christian styles, like the Gothic and the Baroque, were designed in defiance of nature, to show that there are higher spirits more important than the harmony of the natural world, or at least the supposed harmony. During the Rococo and the Enlightenment era, so much pictorial art was designed by schematic before the schematic was painted over. Just about all music ended in the same key in which it began, and the phrase lengths were almost invariably kept in multiples of four measures, while the poetry was by and large kept in the strictest possible couplet form. The expectations of what art was supposed to be was ironclad because the expectations of society itself was ironclad. It was the age after Newton, but before Darwin. For a learned aristocrat of the period, the nature was, as Eric Hoffer might put it, as orderly and harmonious as a perfectly set and wound Swiss grandfather clock. To put it somewhat differently, the earth may have been displaced from the center of the universe, but along with the earth's displacement was moved the church, not the state. For century after century, the state had to orbit around the church. But since generations of astronomers proved that the Earth was not the center of the universe, the church was no longer the center either, and it would be a mistake to think that the two concepts are at all independent of each other. For more than 1,000 years, the geocentric view of the universe was as central to the Western world's conception of itself as Christianity. Geocentrism had been kicking around since Anaximander in the 6th century BC, who thought that the Earth was a cylinder held at the center of the universe, and Pythagoras, who posited that the Earth was a sphere. You can find a better explanation than I can give in Stephen Hawking's Brief History of Time, but I'll do my best to do the 2-minute version. These two concepts of the Earth being spherical and being at the universe center were synthesized a quarter millennium later by who else? Aristotle, who added that the other celestial bodies were spheres orbiting around us whose theory anticipated universal gravitation by holding that the Earth was at the center of the universe because it was the heaviest of the celestial spheres. And all the other celestial spheres like Mars and Venus would orbit around us at a speed directly proportional to their weight. But widespread acceptance of geocentrism as fact only comes from Ptolemy in the 2nd century AD, who added extensive data measurements to Aristotle's observations and in some cases anticipated Kepler's idea that the planetary spheres travel not in perfect concentric circles, but in an ellipse form. Ptolemy was not quite that prescient, but he did note that planets did not travel in concentric circular paths, and therefore he believed that planets travel in orbits within its orbit, forming paths that look like celestial doodles. The center point around this second orbit Ptolemy called an equant. As in so many cases in the history of human knowledge, the truth is radical enough that the human brain is only willing to concede the next most radical option. Authorities, rather than concede Ptolemy's equant, conceded Aristotle's idea that the Earth was at the center of the universe and that the planets move in circles around it. That was the Hellenistic contribution to this form of knowledge. Now comes the Judeo-Christian. Together, I'm sure I don't need to tell you all that often, they form the bedrock of all the Western concepts that came after them. In a moment, hopefully you'll see how the two are related so intimately. The Jewish conception comes at the latest from the 8th century BC when the writers of the Judean court clearly began to refer to Yahweh, or Adonai, and Elohim, and Shaddai, and Elyon as the same deity in their texts, texts which now comprise the greater share of the Hebrew Bible known as the Tanakh. Of these, the two most prominent names for God and the two most often used are, as every Jew knows, Adonai and Elohim. At the beginning of the Torah, or okay, the Old Testament, there are two separate and directly contradictory creation stories. One talking of a deity named Yahweh, whose name is spoken as Adonai in the modern Jewish parlance, which in Hebrew is an honorific for nobles, literally meaning sir or lord. This creation story is the common one we know about 7 days in the world of Eden and ends with the Garden of Eden, a fruitful and bounteous paradise of which man is the master. But curiously, there is a second creation story, one that is both more mundane and more sophisticated. And you can tell why religions emphasize the first over the second. There is clearly a redactor who tried to make the two into a coherent narrative, but he didn't quite make it work. In the Torah, man is created twice. Plants are created twice. Brain is created twice. Animals are created twice. Elohim is suddenly referred to as Adonai Elohim. And the world is not without form and void, but a dry land with nothing but dust. You can suddenly imagine the billions of years in which the earth was a geologic formation without life. Adonai Elohim breathed the breath of life into man and animals and plants, which could even be taken as the process by which inorganic matter found each other to cohere into organic matter. All this took place at roughly the same point in history, between the 8th and 6th centuries BC. The central event in the widespread adoption of geocentrism took place around 150 AD, and the central event in the widespread adoption of monotheism obviously took place in the 33 years following 0 AD. Together, they were adopted by the Byzantine emperor, Constantine the Great, and even more particularly due to the influence of his mother, Helena, in issuing the Edict of Milan in 313, when the Byzantine Empire decriminalized the Christian religion spreading throughout their lands like wildfire. And if not adopting it personally or even as the state religion, as is generally supposed, then at least becoming extremely productive patrons of the Christian faith who built many temples to Christianity. This patronage of Christianity basically lasted for 1,400 years, during which the state realized that a higher allegiance was owed than they could possibly grant themselves. Popes and emperors and kings might be anointed by God as representatives to rule in the temporal world in God's place. The church might even make them saints, but there can only be one God and one ruler in the kingdom of heaven. But if there is a kingdom of heaven, then the earth has to be a place worth ruling too that relates to the glory of God and the wonder of his works. Why would this be? Many early church figures considered it so self-evident that it would be presumptuous, perhaps even heretical, to come up with an explanation. At the beginning of this long era of eternal truths, St. Gregory of Nyssa writes, "And how does earth below form the foundation of the whole? And what is it that keeps it firmly in its place? What is it that controls its downward tendency? If anyone should interrogate us on these and such like points, will any of us be found so presumptuous as to promise an explanation of them? No. The only reply that can be given by men of sense is this, that he who made all things in wisdom can alone furnish an account of his creation. For ourselves, through faith, we understand that the words were framed by the word of God, as saith the apostle. But for a supposedly God-centric view, from which we should be so humble as not to question it, it was curiously man-centric. Perhaps closer to the reality of what this meant for mankind was Gregory's contemporary, St. Ambrose of Milan, who declared of Christ, "Worthy surely was he to stand forth as a man who might stay the course of the river, and who might say, Sun, stand still, and delay the night and lengthen the day as though to witness his victory. Why, a blessing denied to Moses, he alone was chosen to lead the people into the promised land. A man he was, great in the wonders he wrought by faith, great in his triumphs. The works of Moses were of a higher type. His brought greater success. Either of these, then, aided by divine grace, rose above all human standing. One ruled the sea, the other heaven." Take away the poesy. And what this means is that there are representatives on earth, aided by divine grace, to rise above all human standing, therefore chosen by God to rule all temporal creation in his stead. Therefore, because these rulers are appointed or anointed by God, the church, the conduit through which we can all worship him, has primacy over the state, which is present to administer exclusively to worldly matters. But near as this not intellectually humble enough Jew can tell, this, the most important of these early church figures to establishing this de facto primacy of man is probably Hippolytus of Rome, who wrote, "For what richer beauty can there be than that of the circle of heaven? And what form of more blooming fairness than that of the earth's surface? And what is there swifter in the course than the chariot of the sun? And what more graceful than the lunar orb? And what work more wonderful than the compact mosaic of the stars? And what more productive of supplies than the seasonable winds? And what more spotless mirror than the light of day? And what creature more excellent than man? There it is. The humility before the face of creation that to the modern ear sounds like the exact opposite of humility. God is so perfect that he must create beings who are the image of his perfection, as beautiful in our ways as the celestial circles of heaven are in theirs. And therefore, because everything is so perfect in this best of all possible geocentric universes, man, the divine image of God, must be at the center of the universe. Man is the purpose of creation so that he can both appreciate God's creation and also appreciate his likeness to the divine image. And to show how stationary, how incredibly undeveloped this both extraordinarily humble and breathtakingly arrogant mode of life was, let's fast forward roughly a millennium into the future to St. Thomas Aquinas, certainly thought of as the most consequential medieval Christian philosopher, and of whom I shall not claim to have ever read a single page that wasn't from a book or website full of quotes. But thanks to this greatest of all modern incarnations of the divine, Google, we find that Aquinas writes in his Summa Theologicae that theology, as God has taught it, differs in kind from the theology of philosophers. Notice that Aquinas takes it as a given that all philosophers are theologians. Let's also note that the bar to becoming a philosopher was quite different at that time, since it simply meant a person who loves wisdom and therefore studies wisdom. And the study of wisdom can take in any of the sciences or the arts or the humanities, all of which are present in the world to relate to the glory of God alone. Sciences are differentiated by different ways of knowing things. Astronomers prove the Earth round with abstract geometrical argument from the shape of its shadow. Physicists prove it from Earth's concrete physical properties. So something that is the subject of a naturally learned discipline when known by the light of reason becomes the subject of another science when known by the light of God's revelation. Aquinas also writes, however, we cannot argue from a definition of God in this science because we do not know how to define him. Instead, we argue from his effects, be they nature or grace. In certain natural sciences, we do the same, proving about causes not from their definitions, but from their effects. In this stationary, unprogressive universe of the Middle Ages, when all truths are eternal, science is not to be studied for its own effects. Science is the study by which we discover how God's glory is manifested on earth. Therefore, with the displacement of the earth from the center of the universe, the church must also be displaced. It becomes a secondary worldly body, gravitationally drawn into the forceful web of the state, which could weave a society with far greater intricacy than the church ever could on its most organized day. When controlled by the church, what does it matter if peasants are kept in squalor? Blessed are the poor. And the greater the degradation, the greater their reward will be in the world to come. But as horrible as it might seem to our 21st century ears, a nobleman has to look after his property, which is a reflection of his character. If peasants and livestock and land and infrastructure was kept in disarray, it would reflect horribly on the people who ran it. That is not to say that abuses that would horrify us would not be perpetrated every day in every region. It's not to say that abuses that would even horrify people at the time were not committed all the time by noblemen who didn't much care how they were viewed by others. Just think of Mozart's Don Giovanni or certain unusually self-reflected musings from King Lear. But there was a marked improvement, and because there was a marked improvement, there was also a corresponding demand for still greater improvement. More on that in a moment. The point is, while there was evidence which displaced the Earth as the central stationary body around which the universe's spheres revolved, there was no hard evidence yet that the Sun was not at the center, as Copernicus would have it. And like the Sun, the central body of the universe which gives light and warmth and protection and vision, the monarchy was the light of which all society revolved as a reflection of the Sun King's glory. And the allusion to the French Baroque king, King Louis XIV, is not entirely accidental. In such an age, life should be a harmoniously regimented hierarchy in which every person knew his place in the social structure and could be eternally satisfied with it. But as anyone who grew up in the suburbs can tell you, hierarchy and predictability can at times feel, however well managed, like a prison, and when the prison walls come down, the chaos is that much more explosive because nobody remembers what chaos feels like. The Middle Ages were an orgy of chaos. There is no true way of measuring its demography, and because there isn't, there is a distinct tendency in certain circles of the extreme left and extreme right to idealize it. One of the idealizers of the Middle Ages is a political scientist, if one can even call him that, named Alexander Dugin, who is said to be Vladimir Putin's favorite intellectual. Here is one choice quote of his which can be a stand-in for how many people feel about the European Middle Ages. "We need to return to the sign, to the logos, to the fundamental ontology of Heidegger, to the sacred, to the new Middle Ages, and thus to the empire, religion, and the institutions of traditional society, hierarchy, cult, domination of spirit over matter, and so on. All content of modernity is Satanism and degeneration. Nothing is worth. Everything is to be cleansed off. The modernity is absolutely wrong. Science, values, philosophy, art, society, modes, patterns, truths, understanding of being, time and space, all is dead with modernity, so it should end. We are going to end it." It sounds like something Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor would say if he were presiding over Kafka's trial. So let's be clear. Dugin is not saying that we need to kill art or science and values and philosophy. He just wants a complete reorientation in how we think of them. And his admiring mention of Heidegger is the clear indicator of how he thinks of them. And it's also worth remembering that Heidegger was a Western philosopher in whom a lot of archaically minded thinkers hold in very high esteem. Ayatollah Khomeini went so far as to believe that nothing in Western philosophy is worth much except Heidegger. But Heidegger, with his inward and contemplative ideas of pure being and anxieties that gradually creep into our concerns, to say nothing of the Nazi sympathies he held, which keep getting more and more pronounced the more specialists delve into his private papers, is in some ways the ultimate neo-medievalist. Think of this quote from Being and Time. "All being is being," and the second being is capitalized. "To hear such a thing is trivial to our ear, if not indeed offensive, for no one needs to bother about the fact that being belongs to being," once again, the second being capitalized. "All the world knows that being is that which is. What else remains for being but to be? And yet, just this fact that being is gathered together in being," again, uppercase, "that in the appearance of being, being appears, astonished the Greeks and first astonished them and them alone." Heidegger believed that if you went back to the source, you can recapture that initial awe at the discovery of consciousness, before consciousness was supposedly perverted into doubt and perhaps resurrected and prolonged indefinitely. Thinking and poetry were for him one and the same. The truths of great artistic achievement were as literally true in the same manner as great thought. From my obviously limited vantage point, that is a sentiment that is probably true, but no philosopher, even Heidegger, has the intellectual depth to find the levels on which that is true. I'm not at all qualified to say whether or not Heidegger realized them, but to a dilettante like me, it's fairly reasonable to say that he didn't.
And therefore, his search for an entirely different way of understanding thought meant that we had to go back to the very origins of writings about thought. Heidegger did not rely on classical thinking like Aristotle in the way that Aquinas or the church founders before him did. He went back to the earliest pre-Socratic thought. He wanted to go all the way back past the foundations of civilizations to civilization's very dawn, when philosophy and poetics meant the same thing before their arbitrary separation. In other words, medievalism can be considered to not have gone far enough in its rejection of reason. Even Socrates and Aristotle are suspect. Aristotle takes it prima facie that we are rational beings. Heidegger does not believe that. He believes that we are beings consistently hurled forth into the future. He did not think, as Kant did, that space was much of a mystery. But if you think of time as space, then we are constantly stretching new parts of ourselves to grow into the new time. We are not rational beings for Heidegger. We are simply three-dimensional beings trying to apprehend a four-dimensional world in which time is always advancing, and we have to remind ourselves from moment to moment that time has advanced. Therefore, our projection of time is just a projection, and we are always projecting expectations upon the future of what the future is, and therefore our projections and expectations can never reach proper fruition. He goes back to Sophocles, whom anyone who's read Oedipus can tell us is the great poet of how knowledge can destroy even heroes. He goes back to the poet Parmenides, who's known today because of a single fragmentary poem, the slightly Ecclesiastes-like gist of which is that change is a myth, even time is a myth, and the world as we perceive it is a false reality, and even Anaximander, remember him?
The proto-scientist who is apparently the first thinker to truly ponder the idea of beginnings. The period Heidegger clearly had the most sympathy with was the dawn of civilization as we know it, that period roughly around the 8th to 6th century BC, when thoughts about our place in the cosmos were first centralized, though, good Nazi as he often seemed to be, he didn't care much to investigate the Hebrew side of that equation. To this thinking, be it medieval or be it distantly related to modern totalitarianism, decadent thought sets in almost by the mere existence of thought itself. Because thought requires skepticism and critical distance and individuality, which alienates us from appreciating our existence properly and results in all those spiritual diseases that modern language and Sartre would call despair, which leads to the possibility of wide-scale destruction. Against so much evidence to the contrary, Heidegger believed that the world did not have to be this way. The only way to make a world without such suffering is to knock the whole thing down and start from scratch with no guarantee that at the end of all that revolution, all that murder, all that suffering, you've created a world any better than the one you destroyed to make it possible. Had Heidegger been more open to the Hebrew side of knowledge's beginnings, he might have taken Ecclesiastes more to heart, with its idea that for in much wisdom is much grief, and he that increaseth knowledge increaseth sorrow. There are leaders who reassure us that the economic problems we have are not indicative of problems within the human spirit, which is doing just fine, and that all we have to do is take care of some material concerns that with the human faculty for empiricism and reason and invention and dogged persistence can be overcome, albeit with titanic difficulty. Any true follower of the Enlightenment would have to agree that that's at least our best option. In America, we have Obama and Roosevelt and Lincoln, and in this nascent post-American world, perhaps we have Angela Merkel. But there are also leaders like, yes, Adolf Hitler, or in completely different ways, Ayatollah Khomeini, or in a completely different way yet again that perverts the Enlightenment, Mao Zedong, who assure us that the economic troubles that beset us are due to a spiritual crisis and that our material crises are like a gangrenous limb that has to be completely amputated. And once we do, our problems shall cease. Perhaps that limb is Jews, perhaps it's imperialism, perhaps it's capitalists, or perhaps it's Sunni Muslims, or perhaps it's even Muslim and Mexican immigrants. And eventually, it's even the salt of the earth people for whom such spiritual leaders claim to represent who suffer for the failure of the better world to materialize. The consciousness of their followers becomes so pure, so ecstatic, that no amount of critical faculty can compete with the onrush of good feelings they experience, and in the process, if they can no longer doubt, their individuality ceases to matter and they can be mowed down at the leisure of the leader they follow. Humanity will always be a messy substance of labyrinthine complexity, a whole whose parts never fit together. But if you believe that the problems of humanity are due to a spiritual disease, then a guru figure who promises a revolution and a radical break with diseased parts will always be precisely the intellectual narcotic for which you search. This is, of course, a matter further complicated by materialism itself being elevated by both the American right and much of the worldwide American left into its own forms of religion. And we'll get to all that in later podcasts. So consider one of Heidegger's most famous aphorisms. The human being is not the lord of all beings, but the shepherd of being. The second being is capitalized. Now that could just as easily have been said by Anselm or Augustine. It's not just the Christian imagery of the lord and his shepherd, but it has the same medieval patina of humility that says, in the words of the short medieval hymn, the Non Nobis, not unto us, O Lord, but to thy name give the glory. God, in this case, is replaced by the more elusive concept of being. So on the perhaps off chance that God might not be there, and that there's no being either in the sense of a superior being or in the sense of consciousness, as Heidegger generally understands it, and nobody really agrees on how he did, what is it then that we are shepherding? It would seem to me, at least, that all we shepherd towards some kind of transcendent possibility is a bunch of hydrochemical machines who can feel great suffering with no guarantee that transcendence can be attained or even be worthwhile. Or think of the line from his critique of Nietzsche, which he ends by saying, thinking begins only after we have experienced that reason, though glorified for centuries, is the most stiff-necked adversary of thinking. What in Nietzsche was merely strongly hinted at becomes in Heidegger an imperative. The Enlightenment, the glorification of the human mind, is not just a mixed bag, it's a total flop. Reason itself is a self-betrayal. Obviously, this is one of the most grotesque oversimplifications imaginable of one of the most disputed and endlessly discussed philosophers in the history of the field. But it would be very difficult to wade into the minefield that is Heidegger unless you were willing to stay there for episodes at a time, and if I did, you wouldn't. So let's suffice to say that if a certain sympathy with National Socialism might have been an inevitable byproduct of his thinking, even if he spent 1 year as a very public Nazi Party member and then 11 years privately, and retained high hopes of reforming Nazism into something more cultured, Heidegger was also clearly a naif. He was a contemplative man who had very little conception of politics as it was actually practiced. And after his first year as rector of the University of Marburg, during which he was an extremely eminent spokesperson for Nazism who gave enormous intellectual prestige to its thuggery, he mostly retreated back into the life of the mind for the duration of Nazi Germany's existence. Alexander Dugin, on the other hand, is a political scientist, and some have thought him such an effective political activist that they refer to him as Putin's Rasputin. Dugin's main idea is of a fourth political theory, the others of which have been come up with by various Keynesian economists. The first being conservatism of traditional hierarchies, the second being socialism that overthrows class structure in the name of equality, the third being various sorts of centrism that fuse together economic progressivism with social liberalism. In America, we would generally call this liberalism, with the addendum that the way European third-way politicians define it sounds closer to moderate Clinton-esque Democrats of the DLC variety, or perhaps even that now endangered and unrepresented species, the moderate Republican. What European thinkers forget is that if mainstream liberal American politicians like Obama and Nancy Pelosi lived in a northwestern European country where they could advocate for something at least moderately closer to the second political theory, they certainly would, but they can't. But just as Europeans see a third political theory in the American-style marriage of social liberalism to economic progressivism, there is also a more theocratic marriage of social illiberalism to economic conservatism. Now, let's be clear about this. Conservatism, as it's generally defined in America, has become synonymous with illiberalism. But conservatism properly applied need not be illiberal. It's just cautious in its liberality. In the 19th century, a conservative like Otto von Bismarck or Benjamin Disraeli was in many senses more concerned with the plight of the poor than their liberal opponents. In spite of their bellicosity to other nationalities, it was the anti-democratic Bismarck who implemented the first modern social safety net. And it was the arch-imperialist Disraeli who made the British government monitor sanitation and construct working-class housing. In America, a proper traditional conservative would be political figures like George H.W. Bush, who raised taxes and increased welfare spending rather than worsen an economic downturn, or Dwight Eisenhower, who raised the income tax to its all-time high and constructed the interstate highway system. In some senses, their obvious great heir is the Clintons. But if you add a very to the conservative moniker, then you could include John McCain, who has a record of championing campaign finance reform, environmental protection, and treatment of detainees, or Mitt Romney, who, of course, instituted a near-universal health care plan in Massachusetts that became the basis for Obamacare and did much else as a governor that could be considered conservative rather than illiberal. Squint, and you might even call John Kasich an ultra-conservative, though Kasich's record on women's rights is certainly abysmally illiberal. But starting with Newt Gingrich, there was very little either liberal or conservative about conservatives. They were simply illiberal, or more to the point, anti-liberal. Conservatism is not anti-liberalism. It is simply anti-immediate liberalism. When a conservative sees a person of different circumstances, he, or more rarely she, does not see an equal, but they do see a person worthy of protection. A gentry of means and land always looks after his property, and since conservatives generally view America as their own property rather than yours, it would reflect badly on them if the property were poorly kept. But illiberals, which in this case is basically synonymous with anti-liberals, have an extraordinarily different view of the world, and at this point it is best to let Putin's Rasputin once again speak for himself. It is necessary to focus on the fourth political theory. It is based on the existential understanding of the people as a whole, people as Dasein, which, if I may interject, is Heidegger's term for being there. More on that in a moment. But it ascends to the logos, meaning word of God, to the intellectual elite of a fourth way. And this intellectual elite of the fourth way cannot be a nationalist. It should be imperial, great continental, traditionalist, metaphysical, and sacred. And it needs to understand Daseins of all people and to take into account its fine core, to understand their logos, to listen to the quiet voice hidden in the depths of people's being. This elite of fourth way will collide with demagogues and hysterical leaders that a wave of new nationalism inevitably will bring to the front as the foam on the surface of the fermenting sea. And the battle begins now. It would be better that neo-nationalist monster would be strangled in the cradle, but it is about to appear. Therefore now, after Trump's great success, is relevant as never before the general plan for fundamental conservatives and traditionalists all over the world, at least of America, Europe, Russia, Iran, Turkey, and the rest of Eurasia, and the others who will join us. We need a common front aimed not only at the rest of the liberals, finish to drain the liberal swamp is a technical task now, but as well to prevent and neutralize new nationalism. End quote. I'm wondering very much if Dugin is his own translator into English, because whoever translated this has so many spelling and grammatical errors that I have to fill in the gaps of what I would imagine it is his meaning. Though not speaking Russian, hardly dare say that my filling is adequate, so I kept it to a minimum. Philosophy is in the eye of the beholder. I doubt many people would consider this great philosophy. Most academics would certainly tell you that this is not philosophy any more than this podcast is any kind of philosophy. What this clearly is, to my liberal Western ears, and I would assume yours, is a battle cry that uses philosophy as the varnish to polish the sword. Very few people who are not Sunni Muslims consider Sayyid Qutb to be a great thinker, yet his thinking animated the Muslim Brotherhood, incited the assassination of General Nasser, and directly inspired Osama bin Laden. Thinkers do not need to be good to be remembered. They just need to be effective. We do not need to talk about how Ayn Rand inspired so many Americans, though to be sure that will come up in later podcasts. One could even make the argument, one that I think has genuine weight, that it was never the vague theoretical writings of Karl Marx that inspired people, but his journalism, which had so many aphorisms that followers could take to heart as war cries. Just in these two quotes from Dugin, which are consecutive in a text that was clearly written after Trump's election but with no date, we have both a number of striking aphorisms and an incredibly clever subversion of a thinker generally acknowledged to be extraordinarily profound. Just in this little quote, there is a subtle but unbelievably fiendish subversion of Heidegger. Dugin construes Heidegger's Dasein as meaning the people. Now, a thinker as ambiguous as Heidegger would never take something as revelatory as human consciousness and apply it to something as banal as people, or even the people, even if, because he was so ambiguous and removed from reality, he clearly believed in his political life that mass movements could facilitate greater consciousness. In a sense, Dugin's belief is closer to Jung, another Nazi sympathizer, though he never joined the party, with his ideas of the collective unconscious, or to Martin Buber, because of Heidegger's formulation that thought is organized in such a way that we treat every object as something separate from us as a subject. If you view Heidegger's critique of thought through Martin Buber's lenses, then Heidegger would say that language forces us into an I-it relationship with everything of which we speak. Buber believes that we should have an I-thou relationship with the world in which we view all beings as equals. Heidegger believes that it is language itself, and perhaps more basic than language, the human reason that constructs language, which prevents us from having an I-thou relationship with nearly anything at all. But in Dugin, the goal is no longer I-thou. The goal is thou-I, or perhaps even it-I, because the goal itself is for everybody to have the same consciousness, and we treat all other beings not as equal to us, but indistinguishable from us. For Heidegger, that would be absolutely unacceptable. The whole reason to embrace mass movements and mass consciousness is to facilitate greater dignity in people. It would at best be a cheapening of Heidegger's abstraction, at worst an heretical inversion that results in precisely the opposite of the end goal of living lives more authentic to an individual person's potential. That was Heidegger's most cherished goal. But Dugin is not interested in authenticity. He's interested in logos, the word of God. He is a thinker in the tradition of novelists like Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn, who see themselves as much the heirs of Christian theologists like John of Damascus or the Three Holy Hierarchs as they do to Shakespeare and Homer. Both Dostoevsky and Solzhenitsyn believed that the Orthodox Church was the true Christian Church stretching back to Constantine and Helena, who adopted Christianity during an era when Roman pagans still wanted to persecute Christians. These Slavophiles particularly think that the Russian Orthodox Church, easily the most powerful of the Eastern churches, was endowed with a special destiny to bring the world back to God. It is, in its way, a modern and underthought-of Christian equivalent to radical Islam that has not yet reached its full destructive potential. If this man is truly Putin's Rasputin, then if this is what he believes, then it is at least possible that Putin does too. And as absurd as it might seem, this brutally cynical world leader who plays grand strategy like Rachmaninoff played the piano might play it with the ultimate goal of waging holy war. Whatever is Putin's ultimate priority, the ultimate priority of Dugin is logos, the divine word. The most famous instance of the word logos is in the Gospel according to St. John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Dugin's ultimate ambition is not intellectual, like Heidegger's. He does not want to go back to the beginning of thought and restructure thought itself. He wants to go back to the very strict hierarchy of the Middle Ages when the divine word was divine law. What in Heidegger is a world of abstractions is a world of all too concrete realities to Dugin. Without very careful parsing, you could miss that Dugin makes people synonymous with Heidegger's Dasein, which means being or existence or consciousness. What does this mean? It means that in the fourth political theory, people are meant to return to a state of being where they are no longer conscious of themselves as individuals, but exist as a singular mass consciousness. Attraction to mass consciousness was perhaps an inevitable byproduct of Heidegger's thought, but it was not the purpose or the Dasein of it. But mass consciousness is most definitely the Dasein of Dugin's thought. Even if this is not good thought, it's clever thought, it's useful thought to politicians, and what more need be done to make people take a thinker seriously? And just like in Marx, the theory itself, whatever it is nowhere near as important as the aphorisms or epigrams disguised as aphorisms, which spur the reader to action. You might remember this chilling passage from 20 minutes ago. All content of modernity is Satanism and degeneration. Nothing is worth, everything is to be cleansed off. The modernity is absolutely wrong. Science, values, philosophy, art, modes, patterns, truths, understanding of being, time, and space. All is dead in modernity, so it should end. We are going to end it. I count at least 5 potential aphorisms in this half paragraph that could be remembered for hundreds of years. But in a different quote which I've read, you may have earlier noticed his most striking aphorism of all, one that in this case appears in a parenthesis, but I can assure you is scrawled around Dugin's thought everywhere. Drain the liberal swamp. Drain the liberal swamp. Drain the liberal swamp! I don't need to tell you where you've heard this. I don't need to tell you where you're going to hear this. All you have to remember is that when Trump uses this phrase, all he does is extract the word liberal from it, and it becomes just as useful to him as abolish all private property was to Lenin. So if Trump got this from Dugin, the question then becomes, what does Dugin mean by liberal? So let's look at another recent essay of his, charmingly called Donald Trump, The Swamp and Fire. Ahem. The swamp is to become the new name for the globalist sect, the open society adepts, LGBT maniacs, Soros' army, the post-humanists, and so on. Draining the swamp is not only categorically imperative for America, it is a global challenge for all of us. We need to purge our societies of the swamp's influence. Swamp drainers of the world, unite! From now on, the swamp is an extraterritorial phenomenon, exactly like an international terrorist network. The swamp is everywhere and nowhere. Yesterday, the center of the swamp, its core was situated in the U.S., but not anymore. This is a chance for all of us to start hunting them. The swamp no longer manifests itself in a regionally fixed form. Nevertheless, it exists and is still very, very powerful. This all seems like the globalist rapture. They are now absorbed in a non-space, a utopia in the land of the liberal utopia, a no man's land. We are now witness to the deterritorialization of the swamp, the globalist elite, and the world government. What is the structure of the swamp? And this is where it gets important. First of all, the swamp is an ideology, liberalism. We need a Nuremberg trial for liberalism, the last totalitarian political ideology of modernity. Let us close this page of history. Secondly, the swamp is a special postmodernist culture. It is based on the decomposition of any entity through digitalization, obligatory schizomorphism, and so on. To drain it signifies restoring the Apollonian unity of art. Art should return to holism. Thirdly, it is transnational global capitalism. It is the material motor of the swamp. It is loans in the Federal Reserve System printing poisonous green bills. We need to end all of this and return to the real productive sector and mercantilist approach. He then goes on to propound the ideas of some Russian sociologist named Peterim Sorokin, who sounds vaguely like a Russian Oswald Spengler with his ideas of irreversible life cycles in societies. The metaphor is very simple, and we can pick it up again where he leaves off. It is impossible for the swamp to evolve back into a semi-swamp. After the swamp comes the sun, i.e. the fire, the spirit in its radical ideational form. To drain the swamp, we need a solar fire, a great fire which should be in abundance. The swamp and fire are two opposite elements distributed across the earth. Geopolitics now becomes vertical. Both of them can be found at any point. The meaning of place now is the momentum of the process of draining the swamp. Where? Here and now. The USA is the far west of the world. It is the space of midnight, and there the final point of the fall is reached. The moment at hand is one of a change of poles. The west turns into the east. Putin and Trump are in two opposite corners of the planet. In the 20th century, these two extremes were embodied by the most radical forms of modernity, capitalism and communism. Two apocalyptical monsters, Leviathan and Behemoth. Now they have turned into eschatological promises, Putin's Greater Russia and America liberating itself under Trump. The 21st century has finally begun. And he concludes, "So all we need now is the fire. We can't deny it. It's true and staring us all in the face. We liberals, we alleged global elite, are now so transnational that there's no country that will hold us. Liberalism is not tied to country. It is tied to ethics, and in the absolute sense will never declare my country right or wrong the way an absolute conservative or an absolute anti-liberal would. And therefore, it was only a matter of time before we liberals were cut off from nationalism at its very roots. So who then are these liberals? As Dugin would define it, they are postmodernists, schizomorphics, he calls us, which I suppose means that we are so untethered to ideology that we can be convinced to believe anything at any point. It is also transnational capitalism with its paper money and credit, the swamp of which he proposes to drain by returning to mercantilism, in this case meaning the production and trade of raw materials. So socialists and anarchists and Marxists may yet find a place in this proposed world order, as there clearly is a place for Republican anti-liberal elites, whom so often profess to be the ultimate individualists to whom mass movements should be anathema. And yet clearly, in a Trump presidency, they've reconciled themselves for the moment to thriving." Here is part of an article Dugin wrote the day of the election in which he explains both what liberalism means to him and why he can tolerate the particulars of Republican anti-liberalism. "Hillary Clinton is the path of globalism, the unipolar world, and the continuation of U.S. hegemony. Under the present circumstances in which American might is collapsing in all regions of the world, a Clinton victory means war. War against everyone who opposes U.S. hegemony and chooses the multipolar world instead of the unipolar one. Clinton is the old world order, the one which was formed in the early 1990s. This order is coming to an end, but it does not want to be ended. And this means agony. The agony of a small state or nation is one thing. It is scary and dangerous, even toxic. But the agony of a global hyperpower is a monstrous challenge for the whole world, for all of mankind. It is like a titan falling into the abyss. It can easily drag all the others down with it. In fact, Clinton is a genuinely possessed candidate, but not only by virtue of her personal qualities. Rather, her individual obsession reflects the madness of the globalist elites. They still rule the world, but their time is running out. They no longer attract or seduce anyone. People obey them only out of fear and weakness. Hillary Clinton is an image of the insane great mother Sybil who castrated her loved ones. She bears the matriarchal element of horror that demands submission without guaranteeing anything in return. Clinton means war. Donald Trump is the America that we almost lost. This is a huge country inhabited by rustic, naive, and strong-willed people who are each busy with their own personal issues, establishing businesses and companies, work and amusement, but they are all Trump Americans for one reason. They want to feel free. That's it. Trump's supporters are the characters from Ken Kesey's novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the psychiatric clinic patients ruled by the Big Mother, the chief nurse Mildred Ratched. Big Nurse as Big Mother. They see that the globalist elite of Wall Street, the maniacs of the Federal Reserve System, and the ultra-liberals are depriving ordinary Americans of what is most important to them, their identity. As Patrick Buchanan said, America subjugated the world, but it lost itself. The only way out for the real America, the America of freedom, is direct democracy and dignity. This is Donald Trump. In him, there is hope for peace with other peoples. Americans return home to their city on a hill, which has long since been out of sight, forgotten, and abandoned by the transnational elite, the neocons and the global schemers of the CFR, meaning the Council on Foreign Relations, who don't care about America. Trump's America is an America returning to its roots, an America focused on its dramatic situation and renouncing hegemony and global strategies. Such an America could become not only a partner, but a sincere friend to all other nations and peoples. Trump is Randall Patrick McMurphy from Ken Kesey's One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He rebelled against Big Nurse to free all the others. He encouraged them to have faith in themselves and rid them of the fear of the Big Mother's black magic. Trump's battle against Hillary is also a psychoanalytical drama. It is the independent, patriarchal male leaving behind the castrated spell of aggressive and harsh femininity. So let's leave aside the hypocrisy of yet another intellectual who hates the decadence of American popular culture but never stops using examples of it when it suits him. Russia tolerates the radical individualism of the hard American right for two reasons. One reason is less interesting because it's the usual one. Russian nationalism, a resentment of America's ability to impose its culture to the world. America can be a friend to all so long as it is just one nation among many and not a nation that exports its culture everywhere. But this leads us exactly to the second reason, and the extremity of Dugin's sexist rhetoric indicates this reason so charmingly. The second reason is ideological. Russia resents America exporting its ideas across the globe because the ideas are liberal, because the ideas America represents are not just in contradiction to traditional American patriarchal values, but in contradiction to the world's. America, as haphazardly as it's fulfilled its ideals, held out hope that the world is a better, freer, more equal world, which has greater dignity between sexes and races and less income disparity, is possible. As so many governments have, Putin's government doesn't just resent America for exporting its ideas. Putin resents America for exporting good ideas. What those ideas are, even more than it resents us for exporting them. What Russia hates is American liberalism. Pure, boring, unreformed, mid-20th century, rock-rib, Rooseveltian, Cold War American liberalism. An ideology viewed as totalitarian because it's no ideology at all, and therefore invalidates other ideologies. The same liberalism accused of being a perversion of classic liberalism to which Republican anti-liberals want to revert. The same liberalism which socialists and Marxists call neoliberal and think outmoded. The same liberalism which anti-imperialists accuse of being conservatism with the added hypocrisy of a human face. The same liberalism which imperialists accuse of advocating policies no different than anti-imperial terrorists. The liberal whose best motto is to live and let live, and in the course of human events, this liberalism corrects itself to better let us live and let live. It corrected itself after World War I to mean internationalism. Corrected itself after the Great Depression to mean economic progressivism. It corrected itself during World War II to mean anti-pacifism. It corrected itself during the Kennedy era to mean human rights for all. Then corrected itself during the Johnson era to mean that human rights should be a particular priority at home, where unintended consequences can be minimized. And had to correct itself on this matter yet again during the Bush era, because it was conservatives who implemented it and liberals thought they could wash their hands. A liberalism that went from Wilson to Roosevelt to Truman to Kennedy and Johnson to King before its progress was halted and then made manifest again by Obama. A liberalism that adjusted itself by untold numbers of thinkers, statistics, and debates, and constantly evolving itself to give humanity a greater and greater chance at something better for all and not merely the elite. But the greater liberalism's triumphs become, the greater its defeats are when defeated.
Much has obviously happened since recording this podcast a month or two ago. The past 2 months have ensured that there will be much, much more to say going forward about precisely how our era has taken on precisely the spirit it has. But since we have spoken so much about Putin's Rasputin, it would seem that we badly need to take just a moment to speak about Trump's and how terrifyingly similar to Dugin Steve Bannon's worldview seems. I came across an article a while back which raised my alarm to truly red alert. While I don't wish to terrify anyone more than they already are, it seems ever more necessary to scare the daylights out of anyone who will listen in the hope that someone somewhere will come up with a solution to lethal conundrums that seem ever likelier to present themselves. If Alexander Dugin seems preoccupied with one Petrin Sorotkin, a Russian thinker who, to my mind, clearly patterns himself on Oswald Spengler, then Bannon seems to have found American thinkers who also follow Spengler in the most ominous possible way. The article which elucidates this was from Business Insider, hardly a suppository of leftist agitation, and the article piggybacks on Time's profile of Steve Bannon and elaborates on the book which Bannon was said to value so highly. The particular book that seems to infatuate Bannon is The Fourth Turning by William Strauss and Neil Howe. The idea animating the book is the idea of the saecula, which is an ancient Greek concept meaning roughly lifespan, and because within a lifespan, the entire population of the world will die off and be replenished by new people. These new people will lack the memories of the generation who came before. Just to take one obvious historical example that I alluded to at the very beginning of this cast, we now live in a time when you can practically count the number of people who have even childhood memories of World War I on your fingers. And therefore, we have no living memory of the circumstances that lead to it. And that leads us to the book's second Greek concept, the ekpyrosis. An ekpyrosis is, and I couldn't possibly improve on the magazine's description, a cataclysmic event that destroys the old order and brings in a new one in a trial of fire. One finds this idea in Spengler, one finds this idea in Sorotkin, one finds the idea in Strauss and Howe, one finds the idea in Dugin, and clearly one finds this idea in Bannon. It is possible, however unlikely still, that there has been some sort of coordination between the Putin side and the Trump side to find a similar animating intellectual to give shape to the apocalyptic longings which Putin and Trump may share. To say this inevitably sounds like a conspiracy theory, but I was loath to believe that Russia was involved in the hack of the Democratic National Committee listserv long after everyone else had acclimated to it. We are clearly living in a conspiratorial era. Whatever other qualities this era has, it's worth noting that Strauss, Howe, and Bannon all believe that the three great apotheoses of American life were the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, and World War II. It would seem that Mr. Bannon is determined to bring about the fourth. A cycle takes roughly 80 to 100 years to run its course, during which it runs through four stages and four turnings and is about to commence its fourth cycle in American history. One already has the sense that these thinkers are much too mystically inclined for their ideas to be very serious. If one's not careful, the reading of history can easily turn into the astrological mysticism of the testosterone-laden male. The four turnings are high when individualism is weak and institutions are strong. The second is awakening, when institutions are attacked, when reaching the zenith of their achievements because people tire of the discipline to take us there. The third stage is unraveling, when personal expression is prioritized above all else. And the fourth is crisis, when the institutions are too weak to stand and collapse in a great cleansing event. From the crisis, a hero generation emerges who reestablishes the primacy of collective institutions over individualism. Libertarian objectivists tempted to make common cause with Trump take note. We won't go through the cycle of archetypes except to note that the opposite of the hero archetype is the artist, who is the ultimate individual who owes nothing to the institutions who allowed his freedom, which one must say is an incredibly odd formulation for a man like Steve Bannon, who was once such a prolific filmmaker and documentarian. Strauss and Howe seem to list every thinker but Spengler as influences, but the influence of Spengler is so clearly obvious that it's either an act of dishonesty not to mention him or repression. The number four is so unbelievably important in Spengler's work, which he ties not only to the four stages of civilization, but to seasons themselves. In both cases, these theories are anti-individualist, pro-institution, and clearly regard liberal individualism as a force of destruction. But unlike the other figures mentioned, Spengler was an extremely powerful thinker and a magnificent writer who makes the best possible case for an extremely flawed system of thinking. He has an almost occult view of history that to a certain reader can seem to reveal an intricate spiritual machine at work, almost like a divine being that animates the world like a Swiss grandfather clock, that animates civilizations as though they were as alive as humans, with all the same milestones that all human beings reach. Spengler can almost make you feel as though astrology can be developed into hard science. Like many anti-democratic thinkers, it is very easy to fall under his spell, and I must say that there are moments when I was all too seduced by his pessimistic logic. But what Spengler never acknowledged is that such pessimism, even if it could ultimately be true, and of course there's no way of knowing, is completely self-fulfilling. If you are a person of great influence determined to destroy civilization as we know it because such a destruction is inevitable, then of course such destruction becomes inevitable. A destroyer like Steve Bannon has a much easier task ahead of him than whomever succeeds President Trump and may have to build a greater civilization from the rubble of what's destroyed. Spengler was clearly an anti-democratic conservative who believed in the omnipotence of the state, and perhaps that's why Strauss, Howe list a whole dozen thinkers as influences, but neglect to mention the clearest influence on them. However, when Spengler died in 1936, he'd established himself as an avowed anti-Nazi. He strenuously objected to Hitler's treatment of Jews, not because of any liberal notion of tolerance or alleviating suffering, but because it would be a tragedy to reject the creativity of, as he put it, such a gifted people. It is entirely possible that Spengler, however fascist his mentality otherwise, would look upon our new administration's treatment of immigrants with unmitigated horror that we have rejected such a great potential source of talent that can, perhaps, stave off civilization's decline and prolong American civilization's lifespan. The idea of generational life cycles or even civilizational life cycles needn't come from an anti-democrat like Spengler. It could just as easily come from more tolerant liberal thinkers like Arthur Schlesinger, Jared Diamond, or lowercase r Republican conservative thinkers like Arnold Toynbee or Samuel Huntington, or an older liberal thinker like Giambattista Vico, or even an old Tory like Edward Gibbon, or even ancient thinkers like Polybius and Ibn Khaldun. even the novel that made Thomas Mann's career, Buddenbrooks, is not only a chronicle of the Buddenbrook family over four generations of their rise and fall, but a chronicle of a similar trajectory in the entire surrounding German civilization. Maybe it's even where Spengler got the idea. Like Spengler, there are an inordinate number of symbolic details of color, which are tied to rise and fall, health and sickness, youth and old age. But every one of these thinkers and many more have their own lifespan of these theories in which civilization rises and declines in 3, 4, 7, 8, 9, 12 stages. It ultimately doesn't mean a damn thing except as a metaphor, because nobody can agree on how exactly to define a civilization, and nobody can work out the reasons for civilization's rise and fall with much verisimilitude. When 1,500 civilizations have strode upon the world stage, maybe we'll have enough sample size to understand the process. But according to Spengler, there have only been 9. It is not the idea of generational and civilizational conflict between rise and fall, institutionalism and individualism, yin and yang, in which one or the other always has the advantage that makes cyclical theory so dangerous, but the idea that yin and yang must always be in permanent enmity and therefore their conflict must be the result of the inevitable collapse of the defeated. If a world leader thinks that the world is going to collapse and reacts according to his belief, then of course he will bring about a collapse. If America avoided a collapse in the manner of Europe during World War II, and make no mistake, America came closer than we can ever know just about every year between the stock market collapse of 1929 to the end of the Cold War in 1989. It's because of the insistence of many Americans, though of course not enough, that the true enemy was not dissenting forces that seemed decadent, but the intolerance of their dissent. Just as Lincoln expressed the sentiment at the end of the Civil War, with malice towards none, with charity for all, his greatest successor, Franklin Roosevelt, preemptively embodied that sentiment before such intolerance could dominate American discourse. If civilization is to survive, we must cultivate the science of human relationships, the ability of all peoples of all kinds to live together in the same world at peace. Or this other FDR quote, which seems so particularly apropos in our new era. Human kindness has never weakened the stamina or softened the fiber of free people. A nation does not have to be cruel to be tough. This has been the first episode of It's Not Even Past, A History of the Distant Present. My name is Evan Tucker. My producer is Keith Shevlin of AOIS Publishing. And I could never allow myself to be part of a show that didn't include the greatest music I could find. So here, with both absolute sincerity and no little irony, is the Russian Orthodox hymn, Lord, Save Your People.
Much of what happens, what is discovered now, will of course be secret.
Thank you for joining us for this first episode of It's Not Even Past, a history of the distant present, hosted by Evan Tucker. This podcast was produced by Keith F. Chauvelin for the AS21 Podcast Network. Find it on Podomatic, iTunes, Stitcher Radio, Google Play, TuneIn, and media.as21.com. Like us or leave a comment on Facebook at facebook.com/itsnoteven past. Until next time, the past isn't dead. It's not even past.
Copyright 2017, AS21 Publishing, LLC.
All rights reserved.
AS21 Publishing. What do you want your book to be?